Okay, good afternoon to everybody. I think we're just going to jump right in, correct? All right.
All right.
So I'm just going to temporarily put everybody on a mute and allow you to unmute yourselves to ask questions if need be. I'm hoping that we'll have a few minutes at the end of class today to leave for some questions. I appreciate those who were with us last week and kind of last week was a sort of an explosion of sources and information that I threw out at a top speed. And I apologize for that style of presentation. It's not usually how I like to do the class. It's just that I wanted to establish a certain frame of reference right from the outset. However, I've been giving some thought to both the material and the sources. And I would like you, if you don't mind, I'm going to do some housekeeping right at the outset with Rabbi Kelman's permission. I'm going to ask you to book off one extra week for the series. So it was originally scheduled to be a 6-week series. If you don't mind, schedule into your calendar one extra week so that I can, A, slow down a bit. And today's presentation especially, I sort of squeezed two topics into one. And I'd like to spread them out and do them slowly engage and have some time for questions. And so it will be much easier if we schedule an extra class. Unless we find that we're going faster than we need to and we catch up. But I would from the outset like to ask special permission to schedule a 7th week. So just the first week after Shavuos to continue so that I know that I have the time to address the question carefully. In particular, after last week's class, there were a couple of questions on the chat. I didn't have a chance to look at the chat while the classes were going on. And so I apologize for that. But there were two in particular that I want to go back to. I don't know if the people who asked the questions are on the call. I hope they are. One was my reference to the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, as the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, meaning when I quoted the source reference of the Or HaChaim, I added the accolade or the description of Or HaChaim HaKadosh. Somebody put into the chat the question as to why we would attribute the word HaKadosh to that particular commentary and not to any of the other commentaries of the Ramban or et cetera. And certainly that was not to detract from any other commentary and status of any of our classic Mefarshim. It's just that over the course of time, his students, his Talmidim, because of his Kabbalistic orientation, et cetera, sort of describe him, or that's how he's known to by his followers and by his own kind of a circle. And so much like people refer to the Ari as the Arizal or the Arizal Kadosh, or they refer to Hasidic Rebbe's as Admor, it has become duragur or become standard to kind of refer to commentaries by the way in which they're known to their own followers or their own kind of circles. And so that's how the frame of reference of Or HaChaim HaKadosh came about. As far as today's class goes, there are source pages. I'm going to share them with you on the screen in a moment. They are on the website. They're usually on the website a day before the class begins. And I believe that Maxine has just put the link in the chat. So you're welcome to call them up from the chat as well. There are actually two source pages that I originally planned for today. For now, we're just going to work off the first. And if we manage to get through it all and we start the second, great. If not, you have that extra week for that purpose. Okay, so we're going to jump right in. And I'm going to share my screen with you. Okay. Okay. Please feel free to keep your video on so people can see and we can have this as a conversation if you can, if you feel appropriate. And also if you feel sort of stop me and ask me a question, etc. You can put it in the chat. Maxine, if you can kind of follow the chat just to see if there's anything relevant to stop me in the middle of, I'll be happy to try to do that if we can. And we're going to jump right in. So last week we talked about the broad question of the role of Midrash and rabbinic commentary, not rabbinic commentary, but Midrashic commentary in the world of our study of Tanakh, or study of attempt to understand Pshat. And what we looked at in particular was the question of whether or not homiletic interpretation, Midrashic interpretation, what we call, it's easier if I can actually speak to people. So for this part, we don't need the sources. I'm going to stop the share for a second. We looked at the question of whether or not in our understanding of the text of Tanakh, the notion that a text has standing meaning in its literal, simple, direct reading and understanding, even if that is different than the traditional or midrashic homiletic interpretation of a text. And I shared with you a host of commentaries or a host of authorities from Gaonim, Rishonim, Achronim, contemporary sources that all take this same approach and that recognize that there's a distinction to be made between halachic exposition, midrash halacha, in which we take a verse, we recognize that there is an oral Torah, an oral tradition that interprets that verse in a particular halachic ramification. That's one domain, and that's part of what we call the masoret of Torah Shebaal Peh, the tradition of the oral tradition. And the second, which is homiletic midrash, which is the domain of textual interpretation for homiletics, for Musar, ideas, values, concepts, etc., but that is not necessarily halachically binding. And the suggestion that the rabbis had a tradition, they had a Masoret, they had a link, they had a methodology of interpretation that took them all the way back to Sinai in terms of the divine origin of halachic interpretation. They did not have such a masoret when it came to homiletic midrashic interpretation. The textual analysis of Midrash Agadah was left up to individual rabbis and their insights for that moment, more often for the sake of the lesson involved and less for the literal reading or pshat of the text. And that opens up the option, we're going to explore that option in much more detail today, it opens up the option for commentaries to offer alternative reading of the text than appears in the Midrash. Were it so that all interpretation of text had to follow the understanding of the rabbis of the Talmud or the Medrash, even in homiletic context, there would be no room for creativity in terms of new insights, new applications, new interpretation that's not in the Midrash. And that's really the big divide, the foundational piece of what we're suggesting, which is that there is room for originality, there's room for insight, there's room for literal reading, there's room for interpretation within limits, and we're going to talk about what those limits are, for the text outside of the domain of rabbinic midrashic material. Somebody asked the question as to whether or not there's a distinction in this regard between what's in the Talmud and what's not in the Talmud. Not really, because what's in the Talmud is both halacha and homiletics. That was why I shared with you the comment of the Shmuel Hanagi, the introduction to the Talmud, who says there's both halacha and agadah in the Talmud. There's also halacha that's not in the Talmud that appears in the Midrash Halacha or in the Tosefta or the Braita, other halachic works, and that are often quoted by the authorities in halacha. That's on that source page that I'm not going to repeat for now. There is a quote from the Nodu Yehuda who makes that distinction as well. So for the most part, our distinction is between halachic interpretation versus agadic or homiletic interpretation, and not between what's in the Talmud versus what's not in the Talmud. We're going to take all rabbinic literature for this perspective in one context. All right, that brings us to part two of this discussion, which is this question. The phrase that we shared with you last time, which is "Ein mikra yotzei midei pshuto," it's a phrase that appears in the Talmud. No text is interpreted solely in a homiletic manner, meaning a text does not depart from its literal or simple meaning, and there is room to understand the text in its literal interpretation, even if that is not the halachic or interpretation of the Midrash. Our goal today is to understand or to see this concept played out in the classic commentaries. And I want to look at the four primary commentaries on Tanakh: Rashi, Ramban, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra. Actually, we'll take five if we have time with the Radak in Nach as well, and see how they dealt with this question. And we're going to divide this conversation into two parts. For today's, and that's why I added that extra class. For today, I want to look at the commentaries and see where they either address specifically the question of, am I bound by Midrashic interpretation or do I have flexibility in my interpretation? Or recognize that there is such a Midrashic interpretation that's different, but they're going to interpret according to how they see the literal reading of the text. And just to frame the whole context of this course, the course is entitled Midrashic Methodology. What I've done in the first session and in today's session and partly in next week's session is somewhat of a bait and switch, meaning I've shared with you before we get into the methodology of the Midrash, I'm sharing with you the methodology of those who said there's room for interpretation without the Midrash. So we haven't really gotten into the question of, is there a methodology within the Midrash itself that will come in the sessions to come? But I first want to look at the question of the freedom of interpretation altogether. And by way of secondary introduction, if you will, I want to, these two classes in particular, this week and next week, are particularly influenced by the writings of Nachama Leibowitz, Zichrona Livracha. Just to, by way of introduction for myself, I had in my study of Tanakh two significant influences in my years in Israel when I was studying Tanakh. One was the opportunity in the schus to learn directly with Professor Nachama Leibowitz in Yerushalayim for a number of years, and the other is Rav Yaakov Medan, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion, who came for a number of years to Shalvim and taught Tanakh. And so much of my approach to Tanakh, my insight, my understanding, is essentially a reflection of these two great individuals and what their contribution has been. And so to give them credit, if what I share with you isn't from Nachama Leibowitz and it's from Rav Medan or vice versa, because for the most part, those are my two primary teachers in the world of Tanakh. The bibliography for this particular class you have at the beginning. One is Nachama has an article in the back of her book in Hebrew on Sefer Shmot. She has an article about Rashi and Rashi's approach to Midrash. And there's a very foundational work in the world of Parshanut known as Mefarshei Mikra by Ayin Tzadik Melamed. And that is available as well. All right, so let's get right into it. Ein mikra yotzei midei pshuto. What I want to explore are the commentaries of the classic commentaries and how they dealt with a moment of conflict between how they saw the text as a pshat orientation versus how they recognized that there was such a thing called the Midrash that offered a different interpretation. And much of what we said last week is now going to be reflected in the writings of the commentaries themselves. So we're going to start with Rashi. Here is the first source. Rashi is based on this pasuk. I've kind of given you the text upon which Rashi's comment appears and then the comment of Rashi itself. So the pasuk in Perek Gimel of Bereishit says, "Vayishmu et kol Hashem Elokim mitalech badan." They heard the voice of God walking in the garden. Mitalech bagan. Lenuach hayom, in the middle of the day, vayitchabe adam, and then they went and hide, and they went and hid. So Rashi makes the following comment: Vayishmu, they heard the voice of God walking in the garden. Yesh midrashei agada rabim. There are many agadak midrashim. Ukvar sidrum rabbeinu hamechonam bebreishit rabba ubishar midrashot, and our rabbis already ordered them and organized them in this work known as the Medrash Rabba and other midrashim. And here's one of the most important methodological statements of Rashi. V'ani lo bati ela lipshuto shel mikra. I have come only to teach the simple meaning of the text, the direct, literal meaning of the text. Pshuto shel mikra, pshut, simple. And so from that perspective, Rashi is telling you that he considers himself a pashtan. He considers himself one of those commentary whose goal is not to teach homiletics or philosophy or midrash, but to teach me or to understand the pshat of the text. However, Rashi was keenly aware that he also includes many midrashim in his interpretation. In fact, I would say most people are familiar with most midrashim from Rashi's commentary. So Rashi further explains an additional role, which is Ula Agada Hamiyashevet Divrei Hamikra Davar Davu Alafanav, and to include such agadic midrashim, if they serve the purpose of clarifying a word or a meaning of a text in a proper way, says Rashi. There is such a role. There is a role for midrash, according to Rashi's understanding, if it addresses the question of the text. If the question Rashi is struggling with, and we'll explore this in much more detail in part two, if the question can be answered in a manner in which the medrash comes to answer it, and it's textual, then that medrash has a place in Rashi's commentary. And therefore, he says, Vayishma'u, when it comes to this phrase, they heard the voice of God walking, meaning, Mashamu, what did they hear? Shamu et kol HaKadosh Baruch Hu Sheya Mitalech Bagan. They heard the voice of God who was walking in the garden, meaning the question Rashi is addressing is, how does a voice walk? Vayishma'u et kol Elokim Mitalech. They heard the voice of God walking. A voice doesn't walk, right? A person walks, an entity walks, a voice doesn't walk. And so Rashi says you have to recognize the pronoun or the verb referring back to God, not the voice. Shamu et kol HaKadosh Baruch Hu, she'HaKadosh Baruch Hu haya mitalech bagan, as if God was walking in the garden. It's a very simple textual question to which Rashi offers a simple answer, knowing that the Medrash offered a different answer. This is not on your source page, and I apologize for that, but I just pulled off website, Al HaTorah. I give you you can see the text of Rashi together with the Medrash, and the Medrash talks about how does a voice walk. You'll see he says, Hiluch lakol, there is walking to the voice. How does a voice walk? And he gives various interpretations as to what that means. That, says Rashi, is not appropriate here, because in his opinion, the pshat of it is that it's not the voice that's walking, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu walking in the garden, and the voice is of God. So it's a simple reading of the text. Rashi says, oh, there's a medrash, but I don't have to quote that medrash because it's not relevant. I don't think it's correct in its interpretation of the text as a text. This is the principle upon which Rashi is operating. Now, we're going to look at all the commentaries today. My next piece, which is that extra class that I've scheduled for next week, is going to do a deep dive into Rashi. Because Rashi, in particular, has a complex relationship with Medrash. He'll quote some midrashim. He'll not quote others. He'll tell you that some exist, but not quote them. He'll quote them in wrong, in different places. He'll quote some midrashim, but not others. So there's really a whole methodology to understanding Rashi's approach to Medrash that needs a subject into itself. So we're going to do a deep dive into that by itself. Another example, also in Bereshit Perek Gimel, Vayomer Hashem Elokim, Hein Adam Haya Kechad Mimenu Ledat Tov Vara, Ve'ata Pen Yishlach Yado V'Lekach Gam Etzachim B'Chal V'Chai Li'Olam. Behold, man has become like one of us, the ability to know good and evil, lest he stretch forth his hand and take from the tree of life. And so God removes him from the garden, says Rashi. Mishi yichye li'olam, what's so terrible if he lives forever? Once he lives forever, harayu karob lahatot ha-briyot acharav, he's going to mislead other people to follow him, as if he too is a deity, v'lamar afhu eloah, meaning eternity, or eternal life, is a characteristic of godliness. Man lives forever, is likely to transform himself into a deity. That's the threat of why pen yishlach yado, lest he take of the Eitz HaDaat. To which he then adds, yesh midrashei agada, there are midrashic interpretations here that are relevant, that are valuable, but they're not pshat. Aval en miyushavino pshuto, they don't reconcile with the simple meaning of the text. And so I'm offering a different interpretation that's not in the Medrash, but that's okay, because after everything we said last week, I can. It's okay. And that's essentially what Rashi is doing here. Similarly, in the last example, Bereshit Perek Gimel, Cherev HaMitapechet, the sword, the fiery sword that the Malach had went to guard the entrance to the Eitz HaChaim, to the Tree of Life. Rashi similarly makes the comment, Midrashei Agada Yesh, there are Midrashei Agada. There are these agadic midrashim, v'ani eni ba ela lipshuto, but I am coming only to explain the simple meaning of the text. So what I've given you here is three examples where Rashi acknowledges the existence of a medrash, but chooses to ignore it, chooses to offer an interpretation that's different because, in his opinion, the medrash misses the mark of what's considered pshat, and Rashi offers a different meaning. Now, you'll ask me a critical question, which is, what defines pshat? I don't know if anybody's been bothered by that question. I've been avoiding it carefully up until now. But that in and of itself, the question of what defines pshat, when the Gemara tells us that there's a pshat to every text, to every verse, that is in itself the quest of every commentary. The quest of every commentary is to try to explain pshat. When the most of what we call the Pashtunim, or the classic commentaries that are looking to understand pshat, but it is, there is no clear, consistent answer to the question. If there was, then you wouldn't have multiple interpretations or commentaries. There's a lot of ambiguity in the text that leads to different interpretations of the commentaries themselves. I'm going to give you the simplest formula for that I like to use when I teach to understand the at least the approach to pshat, which is that pshat is to look at text in context. The litmus test of whether a pshat fits or works is whether or not the interpretation of the text fits the context in which that verse appears. Very often a medrash will take a phrase or a word and interpret it independent of anything else, independent of the milieu or chapter or a story, just to learn the lesson. And that's why we call it homiletic midrashim. And not necessarily worry about the context of the verse. That is the prerogative of a midrash. When it comes to pshat, our desire is to understand text in context. And here, three examples where Rashi says, there is a medrash, but I'm looking for pshat, and therefore going to avoid that reference. But of course, Rashi was very influenced by Midrashim. Rashi quotes many Midrashim, and many of the commentaries on that we have on Chumash, Rashbam, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, Radak, or many of the classic commentaries, they will all start from the anchor point of Rashi's interpretation and address, okay, does it work? Does it not work? In their opinion, is there a pshat that's closer to is there an interpretation that's closer to the pshat in their opinion? But Rashi is always the anchor point for all of these discussions. That is seen most directly in the commentary of the Rashbam. Rashbam, as I shared with you, I think last week, was Rashi's grandson. He is he identifies himself in this source, Rashbam and Breshid Lamed Zayin, Ani Shmuel Rabbi Meir Chatano Zatzal. I am Shmuel, son of Meir, Rashi's son-in-law, meaning Rashbam is Rashi's grandson. He's the son of Meir, Rashi's son-in-law. So Rashbam, as Rashi's grandson, had a unique perspective to Rashi. And as he begins his commentary on Chumash, he addresses exactly this question, Rashi's interpretation versus his own. And so in this introductory statement of the Rashbam, he makes the following comment. On the Pasuk Ela Toldot Yaakov, Yaskilu v'yavinu ohavai, listen, understand, my beloved, Shekol mashilimdunu rabotenu. By the way, I have issues with this translation. I pulled this off a website. I'm not sure I agree with the way it's translated here. I'm going to translate it freestyle. Kol mashalim dunu rabotenu ki ein mikra yotzei midei pshuto. When our rabbis taught us that there is a simple meaning to every text, despite whatever its halachic interpretation is, afki ikara shel Torah, even though the primacy of Torah comes to teach me, ba'al lamdeinu mirimizata pshata agadot v'halachot v'adinin, it comes to teach me through all kinds of methodological allusions and grammatical anomalies and signs and all kinds of codes that are built into the 32 types of principles of Yossi Aglili and the 13 principles of interpretation of Rabbi Yishmael that we say every morning in the davening, Yishlosh Hashem Midot Rabbi Yishmael. Torah Shabbat Peh has a halachic structure of how to interpret text. And we've been brought up on that study of the halachic interpretations of the Midot, the methodologies of Torah Shabbat Peh from the word go. Therefore, harishonim mitoch chasidutam nitasku lintot acharei adrashot sheinika. Therefore, it's understandable that early exegetes, meaning early commentaries in Tanakh, because of their piety and because they relied so much on their study of drashot in terms of halacha, lo hurgulu ba'omek pshuto shel mikra. They were not really accustomed to the study of pshat. It was sort of an abandoned field, if you will. And therefore, mitoch kach lo hurgulu kol kach b'pshutan shel mikraot. And he says, even Rashi, gam Rabbeinu Shlomo, avi imi, my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, Meir Enei Agola, who illuminated the eyes of world Jewry in his commentary, Shepiresh Torah Nevi'im Ketuvim, he explained, and wrote commentaries on the entire Tanakh, he wrote the commentary on the entire Talmud as well. Natan Lev Lefaresh Pshuto Shel Mikra. Rashi, as we saw in Rashi's own words, had intended to interpret the text in accordance with its simple meaning. And here comes the bombshell of the Rashbam. V'af ani Shmuel b'Rabbi Meir chatano. I, Shmuel b'Rabbi Meir, his grandson, meaning son of Rabbi Meir, his son-in-law. Nitvakachti imo lefanav. I fought with him. I argued with him. With who? With Rashi. Rashbam. Imagine, I mentioned this last week. Imagine the Shabbos table. Rashi with his grandfather. Rashbam with his grandfather, Rashi, kind of having a whole argument about the Dvar Torah and the Parsha that week as to whether or not what's pshat. V'hodali, and Rashi, says Rashbam, V'hodali, my grandfather admitted to me, She'ilu haya lo pnai, had he had enough time in his life, hayatzrich lasot perushim acharim, he would have had to offer additional alternative interpretations. Lefi hapshatot hamitchadshim b'chol yom, in accordance with new insights that are taught and that are creatively offered every day. The notion that there are new insights literally daily in our understanding of Pshat, says the Rashbam. Rashi looked at them and he said, okay, maybe you're right. I wrote what I wrote in my commentary. There are other possibilities. So Rashbam is telling me that in his opinion, even Rashi would admit that sometimes he relied too heavily on Midrashim and that there are other newer, more literal, Pshatot HaMitchadshim, newer insights into the text every day. Extraordinary insight of the Rashbam. And therefore, not surprising that in the Rashbam too, we find places where, for textual reasons, and this comes back to what I was saying about text and context, the Rashbam would often, very often, offer interpretations that are not in accordance with the classic Midrashic understanding of a text. I'll give you an example. I'm going to actually stop the sharing for a minute. I want to do this as a test. If you have the source pages in front of you, that's called cheating. You're welcome to look aside from them for a moment. Simple question. Hebron is called Kiryat Arba. Correct? Kiryat Arba. If you go down to the Marat Machpelah, go down to Marat Machpelah in Hebron, says the Torah calls it Kiryat Arba. Why is it called Kiryat Arba? You tell me. Somebody tell me. Why is it called Kiryat Arba?
The four kings.
Four kings. Anybody else?
Where classic. Who were buried there.
Four couples who were buried there. Any variation on four. Four mothers. Four great tzaddikim of our generation who were buried there. We've heard every possible interpretation. So now let's go back to the sharing of the screen. And here's the Medrash. Here's the Medrash. It's a Medrash in Breshit Rabbah. Batamot Sarah b'Kiryat Arba. Arba means four. Arba'a Shemot Nikula. It had four names. What are the four names? Eshkol, Mamre, Kiryat Arba, and Hebron. This city had four names. Kiryat Arba is one of them. And why is it called Kiryat Arba? Shedaroba Arba Tzadikim, because there were four righteous men who lived there. Ane, Eshkol, Mamre, Ubale, Brit Avraham, who were the partners of Avraham and Avraham. And there were four great people who had their bris there. Nimolu ba'arba atzadikim, Avraham ena eshkol mamre. Alternative Kiryat Arba, because there were four tzadikim, four righteous people who were buried there. And they are Adam Rishon, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Or because the four mothers were buried there. Chava, Sarah, Rivka, Leah. There you go. So you have all the interpretations that we offered moments ago. Says the Rashbam, why is it called Kiryat Arba? None of the above. Says it's called Kiryat Arba because Shem Ha'ish Arba, because the name of the person whose field it was, whose land it was named Arba. That was his name. I don't know why he was named. His mother called him Arba. That was the name his mother gave him. How do I know? Because there's a pasuk in Yoshua that says that the Shem Hebron, the name of Hebron beforehand, was Kiryat Arba, named after Ha'adam Hagadol Ba'anakim, the great man amongst the Anakim. His name was Arba. And so it's called Kiryat Arba. Similarly, in Yoshua Perek Tedvav, we have a similar verse, Kiryat Arba Avi Ha'anak, Kiryat Arba. Arba was the father of Anak. So says the Rashbam, why do I need to jump to a medrash about four when the text is simply referring to something which we know, text and context, namely that Arba was the name of a person. And so the Rashbam suggests Kiryat Arba because that was the name of the person whose land it was. Now, does that negate the meaning for us, Marata Machpelah, and who's buried there? No. But we just need to recognize that who's buried in Marata Machpelah, other than Abraham and Sarah and Yaakov, etc., right? Adam and Chava, the fact that Adam and Chava are in Marata Machpelah doesn't appear in the text anywhere in Tanakh. So that's a medrash. Now, might be correct, we don't know, but it's not based on a text. And that's a very important distinction. So says Rashbam, let's separate pshat, text and context, from midrash. It doesn't even quote the midrash. Another example. Vayetzei Yitzchak lasuach basadeh lifnot arev. Yitzchak went out lasuach. I have not translated this word. I'll share with you an observation about translations in a moment. Towards the evening, and he lifted up his eyes, and there he saw the camels coming with Rivka. The reason I haven't translated this is because, actually it was translated and I took out the translation, something I learned from Nachama Libur Tzichrono Livracha, she drilled into us time and time again. One of the problems with translations is that there's no such thing as a translation that's not a commentary. You cannot translate objectively without commentary or insight or bias. It's not possible, because the definition of every commentary is translation. The very earliest commentaries we have on Chumash were translations, Unklus or Sadyagon. Because the moment the text is ambiguous, then I resolve that ambiguity in my translation. And so it's so important to come back. Now, again, original text may not be something we all master. And so we sometimes we default and rely on translations. That's by necessity. But where the ambiguity is part of the conversation, we have to be very careful. So here's an example. Yitzchak went out lasuach basadeh. What does the word lasuach mean? So the Gemara has a very clear interpretation. Yitzchak, says the Gemara, tiken tefilat mincha, instituted the prayer of mincha. We know from our sources, from the Gemara Brachos and our tradition, that the three main tefilot of the day are attributed to each of the three forefathers, Abraham Shachris, Yitzchak Mincha, Yaakov Ma'ariv. Yitzchak, says the Gemara, established the afternoon prayer, as it says, Vayetzei Yitzchak lasuach basadeh, lifnot erev. And what does the word suach mean? Sicha, which means conversation. Tfila, as it says, tfila la'ani ki atov, the prayer of the afflicted when he is faint, lifnei Hashem yishpoch sicho, will pour out his complaint or his conversation before God. And so sicha, lasuach, we say in modern Hebrew, a sicha is a conversation. So lasuach is to converse. Yitzchak went to converse, to meditate, to have a conversation with God in the field. That's mincha. So says the Gemara. Look what the Rashbam says on this verse. Ve'elach Yitzchak lasuach basadeh. Ve'etzei Yitzchak lasuach basadeh. I'm not sure what it says. Ve'elach. It says the Rashbam, as it says, V'chol siach hasadeh ayin ki adam ki. The pasuk in Bereishit that talks about the siyah hasadeh that had not yet come out of the ground, because Adam, the man had not yet been created to till the soil. Klomar, siyah is a word for vegetation, growth. And if siyah means growth or vegetation, meaning Yitzchak went out latat ilanot vilirot inyanei polav, to go out and lasuach basadeh, to plant siach, to plant in the field, and to check on the status of the work in the field. And therefore, when he was in the field, he saw the camels coming, and he went to greet Rivka. In other words, says the Rashbam, this word, the pshat of lasuach basadeh, means to converse. Sorry, the pshat of the suach, that means to plant. And the indication, if the word lasuach has two meanings, either to converse or to plant, what word in the text tells me which is the more pshat-oriented interpretation or translation? Is lasuach to plant or is lasuach to converse? Which is the giveaway guide, says the Rashbam, to the correct interpretation? The word basadeh, because it's more appropriate for vegetation, for planting in the field. That's what you do in the field, is you plant. Yitzchak went out, lasuach, basadeh, to plant in the field. Says Rashbam, pshat in text and context. The pshat here is to plant, not to converse, not to pray. Now, I need to stop here and ask a question. Does that mean that the Rashbam didn't daven mincha? Because he disagreed with the Gemara that says that the mincha is sourced in this text? That is a rhetorical question. I think it's a foregone conclusion. Of course he daven mincha. Partially because the Gemara offers another source for mincha that's more halachic than this text, but also because the fact that we have a pshat to a text doesn't take away, especially here where it's a halacha context, doesn't take away the veracity of the lesson of the medvish or the derivation or the application of the medvish. The application is correct, even if the association with the text is different. So I can still link mincha to Yitzchak homiletically, and I'm still going to daven mincha. But if I come to understand the pshat of the text, my focus is going to be on the text in context, which in this case, the Rashbam says, lasuach basadeh means to plant or to plant vegetation in the field. Okay, that's another example. How much time do I have? 12:42. I'm going to more or less skip the last example. It's a little bit of a longer one. I'm just going to reference it for you. Who sold Yosef as a slave? This is a very famous piece. This is Nechama writes this up in her one of her Yonim. Who sold Yosef as a slave? Traditionally, every medrash in the book says Yosef was sold as a slave by his brothers. Even Yosef says to his brothers, "You sold me, Hashem achartem otiyena." But if you look at the story, there's a confusion in the text itself. If you look at this text in Breishit, it says that the actually, let me pull off that text for a second. It might just be easier to see it. Let's do this. Sorry, I meant to pull this up beforehand. Why is this going? What happened to this? Oh, I know. There we go. Okay. Breishit, Perek Lamed Zayin. Come down to the end of the story. Brothers are selling, are sitting and they're having a whole conversation about Yosef. What are they going to do with Yosef? They're sitting and talking about Yosef, and they call him the dreamer. They took off his coat. They threw him into a pit. They threw Yosef into a pit, an empty pit. And then they sat down to eat. They lifted their eyes and they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites, or Chat Ishmaelim, Ba Migilad. And their camels were carrying all kinds of, they're clearly going down to Egypt to sell their wares. So Yehuda comes up with a brilliant idea. Vayomer Yehuda l'chav, what business do, what benefit do we have if we kill our brother? Mabetzek kinerog et achinu. L'chu v'nim kerenu le'ishmaelim. Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. And our hands won't be against him. We won't have, he's our brother, we won't have to do anything. Vayishmu achav, his brothers listened. Vayavru anashim midyanim socharim. So Midianite men came who were merchants. Vayim shechu ve'alu et Yosef min abor. They raised Yosef from the pit. Vayim kuru et Yosef le'ishmaelim, and they sold Yosef to the Ishmaelites for 20 kesef. So Rashi understands this pasuk exactly how we traditionally have always understood this pasuk, namely, we're dealing with Yishmaelim, we're dealing with Yishmaelim, and suddenly we have Midyanim. Where did they come from? So Rashi says that he was sold many times. The brothers, Vayim Shechu, the brothers, picked Yosef out of the pit, sold him to the Midyanites sold him to the Ishmaelites. Says the Rashbam, wait a second, that's not what it says. What it says is, V'yavru anashim Midyanim socharim, Midianite men came by, and they, Vayim Shechu, to whom is the pronoun? This is what we call a classic example of an ambiguous pronoun. To whom is the pronoun? Vayim Shechu, Vayalu at Yosef ben Aboy. They raised Yosef out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites. Who's the they? Every medrash, every commentary says, almost every, says that the they is the brothers. Says the Ramban, wait a second, Bayavru and Hashim Midyanim, the Midianites came, and because the brothers were sitting and eating bread, they were far away from the pit. They obviously moved away from the pit so they wouldn't hear Yosef screaming. And in the meantime, Kodem Shabawa Ishmaelim, before the Ishmaelim could have a chance to come, Avru and Hashim Midyanim, another group came, Midyanim, others, and they took Yosef out of the pit. And they sold Yosef to the Ishmaelim. Which, says the Rashbam, explains why in the next pasuk, when it says that Reuven went back to the bor and he couldn't find Yosef, he tore his garment and he comes back to his brothers and he says, where is Yosef? Meaning the brothers never sold Yosef. The brothers took him and threw him into the pit. The brothers didn't realize that the Midianites had come in the meantime and took Yosef out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites. And so the brothers never knew what happened to Yosef. It's a totally different take on the entire episode of Yosef in Sefer Bereishit, which would explain why they don't recognize Yosef in Mitzrayim, which would explain why they never go looking for Yosef. All of the questions Rashi struggles with, Meshbar says, I don't have an issue with that because my interpretation of this text in context is more literal because of this one ambiguous pronoun. Okay. That's the Rashbam. So what I've shared with you now so far is two classic commentaries, Rashi and his grandson Rashbam, and their approach to text, how much they rely on Medrash in their interpretation of the text, or how much they're prepared to interpret the text without relying on Midrash. Moving to, 10 minutes left, moving to some of the other classic commentaries. I'm not going to go through all of it. You have the texts in the source page, and they are translated for you. You're welcome to explore them in more detail. The Ramban, who struggles, whose commentary essentially is into a larger part, is a response both to Rashi and Ibn Ezra. We haven't gotten to the Ibn Ezra yet. But here, I'm going to skip most of the Ramban. I'm just going to share with you a couple of pieces from Ramban, very famously here in the story of the rainbow, where the pasuk says, "Zot otapita sharanino ten." I'm putting my sign after the flood, my sign in the heavens, which is the rainbow, is a sign of the brit between God and man. So Rashi understands that God has created the concept of a rainbow at that moment, and it's a sign of the brit between God and man. Ramban, who was much more open to scientific information, says, wait a second, we know from the Greeks and the science of the time that the rainbow is a phenomenon of nature. The rainbow exists in nature because it has something to do with air, heat, and light, heat, and water. Exactly what that formula is, I don't think they knew quite mathematically, but he knew that it had something to do with that. And his proof is that you can find a rainbow in a puddle, in a vessel of water, not just in the sky. And therefore his interpretation is not that God created the rainbow, but that God took a phenomenon of nature that existed and used it as a sign for the covenant. Again, a very different interpretation than all of the commentaries who came before him, leaving aside the question of the Medrash. Another example, very famously, is the Medrash. Chazal very often take the approach that all of the Avot kept all of the mitzvot. Rav Mitzvah and Yaakov kept all of the mitzvot based on Ruach HaKodesh. Rashi makes this observation in a number of places. Lot, who feeds the Malachim Matzah, says Rashi, or other examples where the Avot are identified as having observed all the mitzvot. It's based on this pasuk in Breishit that Ekev Sheshem Avraham B'Koli B'Yishmo Mishmarti Mitzvotai Chukotai V'Toatai. Abraham hearkened to my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, my laws. What statutes and laws is Abraham keeping? Says Rashi, is referring to Torah Shebal Peh, Halacha, Moshe Misinai, everything, all 9 yards. To which the Ramban asks the very famous question, wait a second, if that's true, right, in Kain, Yeh Kol Zer Banu Yaldat Sheya Avraham Mekayem Umshameret HaTorah Ad Shelo Nitna, that this assumption that Avraham fulfilled all the mitzvot of the Torah before the Torah was given, how could Yaakov have created a matseva, which is prohibited by the Torah? How could Yaakov have married two sisters, which is prohibited by the Torah? How could Amram marry his aunt, which is prohibited in the Torah? How could Moshe have established 12 matsevot by Mamad HaSinai, which is prohibited by the Torah? On and on and on. That doesn't make sense. And so he says that the pshat is that the Avot didn't keep 613 mitzvot. They kept the mitzvot that were given. The seven mitzvot b'nei Noach, the command of the conversation that appear in the conversations between God and the Avot. God says to Avraham, Lech Lecha, so that's a mitzvah that he kept. The Akedah, that's a mitzvah that he kept. Emunach, and Barachum, compassion to emulate God, Halach to Bidvachav, to walk in his ways, Takao Mishpat, that's a mitzvah that appears in the Torah in Breishit. Mila, that's a mitzvah that he kept. But they didn't keep Ruach HaKodesh, were not obligated in mitzvot that didn't exist yet. That is a classic example of an approach to pshat, which is a classic anchor, appears throughout the Medrash, that the Avot kept all the mitzvot, and therefore attribute to Avram, to Yitzchak, and Yaakov, all kinds of circumstances related to specific mitzvot that haven't been given yet. So that's another example. The Radak I'm going to skip for now because we are going to run out of time. It's three examples of a Radak, or two examples of a Radak in the case of the sale of Yosef. I'll just show you in the end of this source page on the Radak. I gave you a series of quotes scattered throughout Tanakh in which the Radak is seen as offering an interpretation that is not in accordance with the Medrash. He says, "Divrei Chazal im Kabbalah b'yadam aleinu l'kabbalah." If we have a Masoret, if you think it's part of Torah Shabbat, fine. But if not, I'll offer you a different interpretation. Hadrash ein tzurich lichtov ki nadal rachok. This medrash, or whatever context it is, whatever the verse is far from the pshat. That hadrash b'katuv. There is a textual, a midrashic interpretation, but it is rachok. It is different. This midrashic interpretation is very far from the pshat of the text, and on, Adak classically quotes midrashim, but then rejects them because of his seeking the pshat in the text. The final source that I want to share with you is, again, the four or five pillar commentaries of Tanakh, Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, Rashbam, and Nach, the Radak. So the Ibn Ezra is the most difficult of all of the classic commentaries to understand, partially because he was a poet, and he writes in a very poetic, cryptic style. He has in his Hakadama to Sefer Breishit, he has a lengthy exposition on his methodology, but it's written in a poem. It's written in classic poet in his poetic style, in rhyme. And it is, so I've just pulled out a couple of phrases from it. for us to understand exactly this piece. But he writes, Haderach HaChamishit, the fifth approach to exegesis, Musad Perushi Aleh Ashit, upon which I will establish and fix my approach interpretation, which is right in my eyes, Yeshra Be'inai, Nochach Pnei Hashem, if you pronounce God's name, it rhymes, Hashem Imenu Livado Ira, God alone whom I fear, and I will not show favoritism in my interpretation of the Torah, V'lo Asa Panim B'Torah, Chapes Etev Dikduko Mila B'chol Mo'adai, I will look for the literal, grammatically correct interpretation with all my strength, and interpret it according to my ability. He makes reference here to something which is very famous, that his interpretation will always be in the first place that a word appears. And then he writes, Ubavur hadrash, as for the medrash, derech hapshat, and enenu sara, the approach of the midrash does not, we will not depart from the approach of pshat because of the existence of drash, kishivim panim b'torah, because there are 70 faces to Torah, and drash is one, and pshat is another. And my interpretation is driven by desire to understand pshat. And with the exception of halachic information, which we, of course, are bound by the midrash, which we've talked about last week. And so that kind of pulls together what I hope is a kind of a overview of the first two major topics, which is to recognize the scope of Medrash, the limited scope of Midrashic interpretation as a homiletic approach of the rabbis in the throughout the period of the Talmud, which may not necessarily fit pshat, and therefore when it came to the seeking interpretation of the text, the Mefarshim, we saw the methodology last week, we saw the application this week in the Rishonim, took to trying to understand pshat. Now, having said that, this is my segue into next week's unit, which is that they also recognized that not every medrash is created equally. Meaning, not every medrash is pure homiletics and divorced from textual insight. And sometimes midrashim can be very textual. And the question is how to find the textual pshat of, or the understanding of the text within the methodology of midrash. And for that, we need to do for next week, a deep dive into Rashi. Because Rashi is, amongst all the commentaries, Rashi is the most consistent in his drive to see pshat-oriented midrashic interpretation. And that's what we're going to look at next week. Nechama has Nechama was probably the trailblazer in Jewish scholarship in across the board in terms of methodological approach to understanding Rashi. She has, besides her, what she's famous for, which is her books or studies in Chumash, and her Gilyonot, which are questions that she wrote every week for 50 years and people would write answers to her. She also wrote a university course for the Open University on Rashi's interpretation and the methodology of Rashi. It's a two-volume set. And she wrote this magnificent essay called Understanding Rashi's Approach to Quoting Medrash. And so we're going to do a cross-section sampling of very basic sample examples of the methodology that Rashi used at times to quote Midrashim. And that'll be our segue into a deeper understanding, not so much of the limitations of Medrash, but now begin to understand, okay, what role is the methodology? Can the Midrashim play a role in our understanding of Pshat? As I said at the end of the class last week, Midrashim don't necessarily have to be taken literally, but they all have to be taken seriously. And so to take seriously, we need to address in our seeking an understanding of the text, what role the Medrash plays, and when to say, okay, we're going to work off this Medrash, versus when we're going to say, okay, we're going to leave this Medrash aside and offer a new insight. Okay, then I will stop and I will pause for questions. There's a couple in the chat, and I'm sure there are questions in the group. Yes, anybody have any question they want to throw out to the group? Now's your chance.
Hello?
Yes.
I wrote to you privately. I've actually written a book on Ibn Ezra, and I spoke to you at the last speaker where I actually go into his meanings of Pshat and Drash. I wrote to you privately because I didn't want to, Canadians don't like people boasting. I'm from England, and I'm sorry that other speakers, unlike you, have been very rude about Ibn Ezra, who is a genius. And I also argue that his attitude to Midrash is not as negative as people think. So it's called Deconstructing the Bible by Routledge, and it's been very well reviewed, actually. And it's all in all Israeli universities and yeshivot and things. So I love your course. I think you're very good.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the reference on the Ibn Ezra. He is... the proof that he's grossly underestimated and not understood is from my own experience, I have a very hard time understanding the Ibn Ezra. Of all the commentaries, I will admit, the hardest time understanding the Ibn Ezra.
Yeah.
It's language and a poetry that is just different. And so I would look forward to such a...
Well, I started out as a translator, and also this great guy in Israel, Moshe Idel, who's a very great expert on mysticism, and and also a great Ilui. He said I should do it, even though I lived in Liverpool. And I said, how can I do it if none of the Israelis did? He said, you're quite good at languages, because I was speaking to him in French at the time. And, you know, it was just magic. He was just a marvellous man. And it's very sad that people, you know, the things I don't understand, and I'm very interested to learn. So I've spoken twice now because I'm very keen on Professor Lokshin, but he's always rude about Ibn Ezra, and it's just not warranted. You know, he is very great, and he comes, you know, he's from a different area than Rashbam. He's from Spain, although the Christian part, not the Muslim, and he traveled, and he was killed in a pogrom in England in 1164. So that's the second reason I'm so interested in him, you know.
Sure. Okay, so, thank you. Any other questions?
What's the name of your book?
Oh, I've already said it because you're Canadian. I'm very careful not to sort of push myself. Deconstructing the Bible, Abraham Ibn Ezra's Introduction to Torah. When I first came on Torah in Motion, it was Professor Lokshin talking about Rashbam, and someone started a chat privately with me, who's absolutely brilliant, from Toronto, who is now a member of our group in England by Zoom. And he said Ibn Ezra really needs explicating because he's philosophical as well, and he's in that era. But what a genius, you know, an amazing person, very modern in many ways.
I'm just going to pull this back for a moment. There was a question here posted. If you're we're over the time, so if you need to log off, that's fine. I will not be insulted. But there's a couple of questions in the chat, so I'm just going to pull that up for a minute. One is translation about the words and cultural baggage. That is true. Right? That is one of the dangers in translation, is that words change their meaning over time. And so not only do I have a challenge in translating a word, I have a challenge in translating a word in the context of how it was used at the time. I like to use the example of the word olam, olam hazeh, olam haba, this world, next world. How many verses and insights in the Medrash have we seen based on the word olam? You've heard the phrase at the beginning of Mesilat Yesharim, olam, olam chesed yibaneh. The famous interpretation of the phrase, pasuk in Tehillim, olam chesed yibaneh, which is classically understood as the world was built on the characteristic of chesed, of kindness. But that can't be the pshat, because the word olam in Tanakh is never used to describe a word, a world. The world is called tevel. The word olam, ayin vav lamed mem, in Tanakh means eternity, l'olam va'ed. And it only ever means eternity. And so the phrase olam chesed yibaneh in context, meaning in Tanakh, means God's kindness endures forever. Olam, or le'olam, God's kindness, chesed, yibaneh, will be established. Chazal used the word olam to refer to the world. And it's a different application altogether. Hence, the rabbis talk about, in their own language, Lashon Mikra Luchud v'Lashon Chachamim Luchud, that the language of the rabbis and the language of the Torah or Tanakh are sometimes different. They can sometimes have the same word, different meanings, because words change over time in any language. They certainly change over time in English. They change over time in every language. And that is certainly true for biblical Hebrew as well. And so one has to be extremely careful with translations to make sure that if one is looking for the pshat, that comes back to the phrase text and context, that it is the context that drives the correct interpretation. So I appreciate that, that insight. Okay, I'm going to stop here, and there are more questions in the chat. I'll try to look at them over the week, and if and try to address them at the beginning of the session next week if we can. All right, so I thank you all, and I will stop the recording here. And Maxine, if you can just save the chat and send that to me, that would be helpful. Will do. Thank you.
Yasher kochacha.
Baruch Yerba. Yom Atzmaut Sameach.
Gam lachem. All of you should have a meaningful Yom HaZikaron and a wonderful celebratory Yom Atzmaut. Take care.
Amen.
Thank you, Rabbi Shulman. Thank you.